This one goes out to all our new interns who have just survived July and their first off-service rotation. No matter where you're at, I'm sure you've felt this way at times, and I hope you can take some comfort knowing that we've all been there too. This month is Cardiology Month here in Tucson, and we're going to do a brief, not all-inclusive review of the American Heart Association guidelines on dealing with low-risk chest pain patients. There's a lot of opinion in here, so remember, when you hear the "it's evidence-based," when you hear the "it's as good as my few years of experience," our world's worst ER doc pays a visit to discuss syncope, and I round out the talk with some personal words of experience from Dr. Peter Rosen on the ED-ACS dance. Take your own pulse, and let's get into some AZMcast. Happy August, Jared.
Happy August to you, Aaron.
So I just got back from Dallas. I took a beautiful trip from sweltering heat of Tucson to the sweltering heat of Dallas for a few days to do ACEPS Teaching Fellowship, part one. So luckily they didn't let us outside much, but they fed us like mad. Yes. I mean, there was food every 2 hours. I have never had so much freedom to eat, to go to the bathroom. Like,
meat.
I thought I was going to get a
sweats.
Post-obstructive diuresis from after working in the ER and having to hold it for a whole shift. So it was really good. There were some really good speakers there. Hopefully we can incorporate some of that to make this better too. We met some great people that are doing similar stuff. I wanted to shout out specifically to one of the guys out in Kentucky, Jonathan Broner, who is going to be working with Rob Rogers to do a new podcast. I'm not sure how much I can talk about it because they haven't started it yet. But he was listening. He gave us some pointers on July. So somebody that also does this is going to be watching our back now. So we better be careful.
Fantastic.
All right. So this month is chest pain here at the good old University of Arizona. So we were going to discuss chest pain, and specifically low-risk chest pain. We did this our first year of starting, where we had three or four different attendings. We gave them the same case and we said, what would you do with this patient? And wouldn't you know, we got five different answers. It's definitely difficult, but I think before we can talk too much about what we would do with low-risk chest pain, it'd be good to look at what the guidelines say that we're supposed to do. So we're going to look real quick at the American Heart Association guidelines.
Yeah, when you brought up we should talk about low-risk chest pain, I was thinking about the best way to attack this. And I started thinking, you know, what is low risk? I mean, what is the definition of low risk? We talk about this all the time. Oh, the patient has a good story and risk factors. You know, they're at high risk or intermediate risk, or oh, this patient doesn't have a good story, they're at low risk. What does that actually mean, and how much of a risk are the risk factors? Because if you think about our patient population, many of those patients, I would say most of those patients, are diabetic and or hypertensive and or hyperlipidemic. So, and we don't have people having MIs all over the place or having ACS all over the place. So to me, that means one of two things. Either our barometer for risk needs to be recalibrated, or the risk factors aren't as big of risk factors as we think they are. And so I started thinking about, where do they get the risk factors? And most of them come from the Framingham study. You know, the Framingham study has an interesting history. It was started in, I think, the 1950s or 60s, something like that. And I think it's in the fourth or fifth generation, and it's from Framingham, Massachusetts. And the reason they chose Framingham, Massachusetts is because it was a relatively stable population. And so there wasn't a lot of people moving in or out of the city, so that they could capture that population and follow them over time. They could do a cohort study. And with a cohort study, what you can do is say, okay, we're going to take this group of population with diabetes and this group of population in the same city without diabetes, and they have the same environmental exposures and whatnot. We're going to follow them for 30 years and see how many of them get cardiovascular disease. And from that, you can say, oh, if you have diabetes or hyperlipidemia or whatever, hypercholesterolemia, your relative risk of developing cardiovascular disease over 30 years is X, Y, or Z. Now, in all honesty, I was working a couple shifts this weekend, so I didn't have a chance to actually go find the specific risk ratios, but I did spend a little bit of time trying to find them. But there's, you know, thousands of studies off this Framingham thing. What we want to know is, of our patient in the emergency department that we're seeing right now who has hyperlipidemia and diabetes and hypertension, what are the odds that they have acute coronary syndrome, which is a totally different question. So I found this one article. It's actually a pretty good review, published in 2008 in kind of an obscure journal, but it was written by...
That's how you know it's good.
It was written by Christopher O'Donnell and Roberto Elosua. And what they did is they kind of went through each of the risk factors and looked at how much of a risk are they for cardiovascular disease. And we'll put this up on, if you look at your screen, we'll have it on the screen. But the one thing that I find interesting is all of these things are risk factors for cardiovascular disease, not acute coronary syndrome, which is what we're worried about. So from my perspective, it's all a matter of how do we frame the question. When we say this patient's low risk, what does that mean? And what does that mean to you? What would you say?
So somebody to me that is low risk for for acute coronary syndrome is somebody that's low risk for coronary artery disease, somebody that has a story that doesn't quite sound like angina, and somebody who is well appearing after a period of observation, two troponins and two EKGs.
Okay, when you say low risk for coronary artery disease, what does that mean?
The Framingham risk factors are the ones that I typically use.
So let's say it's a diabetic with hyperlipidemia who's 40. Is that the same risk as somebody who's 60? Or what if it's type 1 diabetes when they were diagnosed when they were 16 versus a type 2 diabetic who was diagnosed 5 years ago? Are those the same risk? You know, we don't take those things into consideration. We just say diabetic.
Well, and I think diabetic, you can say elderly, you can say female, you can say non-white ethnicity, you can say lots of these other risk factors that literature has shown over time, they don't have classic angina. Classic angina is the 50-year-old white accountant who's clutching his chest with the Levine sign. I mean, that's your classic angina. I can see the guy right now. He's wearing a clip-on tie and a short-sleeve button-down shirt. I mean, that's your MI that guy's clearly having angina. So there's lots of other things to consider. And I think trying to pick up these patients is difficult. The patient that comes in who's diaphoretic, who is clutching their chest, who's saying that this feels like their last heart attack, we're all going to pick those up. The medical student's going to pick that up. The guy that's helping put new doors on the room is going to pick that up. Wow, that guy looks like crap. He's having a heart attack. What we're trying to pick up is the needle in a haystack. It's easy enough, so to speak, to click a button, order two EKGs, order two troponins, and observe a patient for a period of 4 to 6 hours. When we do that, we take your risk of having an MI down to less than 1%. And that less than 1% is really a needle in a haystack. I mean, it's hard to try to weed out who's going to be high risk within that less than 1%. We've already kind of said that's how we qualify low risk. So the question I'm curious about is, are we saying low risk just from history and physical? Are we saying low risk from a single troponin, single EKG, or low risk after two troponins and two EKGs?
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to do is quantify low risk rather than qualify low risk, because, you know, we can sit here and talk about what our gestalt is for low risk, but how do we quantify that?
So I think that, you know, what I mentioned earlier, if you have a history and a physical exam that is reassuring, you have two normal EKGs and two normal troponins separated out over a period of time, that has correlated to a less than 1% risk of acute coronary syndrome.
In the what duration of time? Over the next 30 days?
You know, I'm actually not sure.
Yeah, see, this is an interesting thing, right? Let's say the person who just got a cath. Oh, I just got a cath or a nuke stress a month ago, and I've got crushing substernal chest pain, and I'm a diabetic, and I have two negative troponins. What does that mean? You know, and the other thing to take into consideration is Framingham, Massachusetts, it's not Tucson, Arizona, right? I mean, I would imagine that the population in Framingham, Massachusetts is mostly white, European descent people, not Hispanic descent, or if you're not, it's not the same population as Mobile, Alabama, or whatever. So how much can you really apply those numbers to your current population? And lastly, you know, every time we mess with the definition of the disease, the prevalence of the disease changes, right? Or every time we get a more sensitive test, like we get these ultra sensitive troponins, does that change how much of a risk the risk factors are and how much we need to diagnose this low prevalent disease, right? I mean, 8 to 10 million people come to the emergency department with chest pain. Less than 5% of them are having a STEMI. You know, 25% of them might be having an end STEMI, but that I could tell you 25% of the patients I see with chest pain aren't having end STEMIs. I'd say it's more like 10%. And so the American Heart Association statement on testing low-risk patients presenting to the emergency department with chest pain, published in 2010, what they say is under identification of low clinical risk, those with a less than 5% probability of MI. But it doesn't say over a certain period of time, right? If you have a negative workup and you come back 2 weeks later, do you need another full workup? Or can you say, what's the warranty on that? 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? I don't know.
You know, it's interesting. I've asked the cardiologist a few times of like, hey, what's the duration of a cardiac cath or a nuke med stress test that, you know, how long is it good for? And I've gotten varying numbers depending on who I ask. For the most part, most of the cardiologists, as far as their intervention is concerned, a cardiac cath is good for at least a year. A nuke med stress test, I've heard anywhere from 3 months to 6 months. And those have been the numbers that I've been told. I don't have any literature that I know of about those. But if I find any, I will insert it right here.
So what's a good story? You know, we talk about, oh, they have a good story. What does that mean? Right? Is that the classic guy with the elephant on the chest? So I looked this up. In 1998, JAMA, in their Rational Clinical Exam series, they published an article, Is This Patient Have a Myocardial Infarction?
I love these. Real quick, if I can do a plug for these, I get nothing from JAMA. JAMA has these rational clinical exams that if you want to know more about, you know, trying to figure out who's having a PE, who's having an aortic dissection, does this kid have appendicitis, if you've never seen this before, these articles are fantastic because they really drill down to the sensitivity and specificity of some of the history and physical exam things that we just take for granted of saying, well, I took a whole history and physical from top to bottom and I don't know what to do with this information. These are really good and you can find them on a lot of diseases.
Right. So what are those components of the story and exam that come up that correlate with a good story, right? So based on the rational clinical exam from JAMA, the most powerful, I'm just reading this from the abstract, the most powerful features increase the probability of MI and their associated likelihood ratios are new ST segment elevation, that's kind of obvious, right? New Q wave, chest pain rating to both the left and right arm simultaneously, the presence of a third heart sound, and hypotension, right? So those things are slam dunks, right? They're no-brainers. The most powerful features that decrease the probability of an MI are normal EKG, pleuritic chest pain reproduced by palpation, sharp or stabbing chest pain, and positional chest pain. So to me, that doesn't really answer the question. You know, none of the stuff that we talk about is really in there. Crushing, substernal chest pain that radiates down the left arm, none of those are even in here. So what is a good story? To me, when I read this, and I read the stuff from the Framingham study, it makes me think, we don't actually know what we're doing.
So I think if you have a potentially deadly disease, you're going to want to cast a wide net. So we've got people that come in with epigastric pain that we're getting troponins on. Well, why are we getting troponins? Well, because it could be an anginal equivalent. We have old ladies come in that complain of weakness. I just feel weak all over. Why are we getting troponins? Because this could be an anginal equivalent. One of the weirdest ones I had ever heard of was when I was an intern and one of my seniors, Mark Urban, told me about a patient that he just got a screening EKG on because she had hiccups that hadn't gone away. And lo and behold, she had an inferior MI, and her inferior portion of her heart was tickling her diaphragm and causing hiccups. But I mean, what a weird thing. You know, how are we supposed to catch every single one of these? I think that's a discussion for a different time, right? Of should we be expected to catch every single one of these?
The most obscure one I ever had was this guy who kept coming in for dental pain, and people kept giving him penicillin and sending him home, telling him to go see a dentist. And finally, after 2 weeks of coming in, he came in two or three times, a couple different hospitals for dental pain. or jaw pain, I check a troponin on him, it's like 140 or something. It was ridiculous. So back to the guidelines, the AHA guidelines. They define a low-risk patient for ACS as those with no hemodynamic derangements or arrhythmias, a normal or near-normal EKG, and negative initial cardiac injury markers, which correlate with a low likelihood of ACS in Table 1. And just to read Table 1 for you, they say low likelihood is an absence of high or intermediate likelihood features, which what we describe as chest or left arm pain or discomfort is the chief complaint, a known coronary artery disease or MI, age greater than 70, diabetes, male. Those are things that are both intermediate and high likelihood. So if you don't have any of those and their history is consistent with probable ischemic symptoms in the absence of any of those other things I just mentioned or recent cocaine use, their examination shows chest pain, chest discomfort reproduced by palpation, which we know that's kind of BS too. There's a lot of people who have, if I pushed on your chest right now, it would probably hurt. If you pushed on my chest right now, it'd probably hurt.
It probably wouldn't if I pushed on yours. I'm not that big.
I'm a little bigger than you, but the point is you push on anybody's chest, it's going to hurt. So I don't know how much I believe in that. The EKG shows T wave flattening or inversion less than 0.1 millivolts in leads with dominant R waves or normal EKG, and the cardiac markers are normal. So these are really the patients. Would you send home a hyperlipidemic, hypertensive patient with chest pain that sounds ischemic and T-wave inversions?
I wouldn't send them home just because you said chest pain that sounds ischemic. I mean, I think over the time of seeing multiple dozens of hundreds of chest pains, you start to develop your own gestalt of who ends up with an MI and who doesn't. This is a plug for the residents to make sure that you are doing follow-up on your patients. You may see 12 chest pains in a shift. All you picked up was chest pain. One of those is going to have something bad, and that can help train your gestalt. But no, if it's chest pain that sounds ischemic, I feel uncomfortable sending that one home.
Yeah, I agree. Which brings me back to my original point at the beginning of my soapbox, which is that based on the AHA low likelihood criteria, the answer to my original question is that our barometer needs to be recalibrated.
So what they've defined is that if you have a patient that you don't feel comfortable sending home, that's not a low-risk chest pain patient, which is legitimate. So we talked about some of the risk factors. One of the other things that I think helped train my gestalt is how does the patient feel? Not only do they have two negative troponins, two normal EKGs, but when you go reevaluate the patient and say, hey, your marathon session in the emergency department, it's now probably 8 hours considering the few hours you waited before you got in here, we found that everything looks okay. How do you feel? I want to go home. I'm sick of being here. How's your chest? It feels fine. I feel okay. All right. So we need to do something about that. The patient that says, Doc, I don't feel a single bit better than when I got here, that makes me a bit nervous. You know, you have to train, is this person trying to play me or something? But I think that the patient that doesn't feel any better, that's the real gray area of unstable angina that's tough to ferret out.
Right. Let's just agree that patients who have unstable vital signs, hypotension, very concerning EKG symptoms, and a trope of 0.05 or something, let's just agree that those aren't the patients we're talking about. We're talking about the guy who comes in and says, I've been having chest pain off and on for a few days, and I've got some T-wave inversions or some flattening. Maybe it's anatomic distribution, maybe it's not. I don't know if I'm diabetic because I don't really go to my doctor that often, and I have two negative troponins. What do you do with that guy? The AHA would say you send that guy home. I would say, can he actually get into a doctor, or is he just going to come back in 48 hours?
So let's talk now about what the AHA says. The guidelines, what they recommend is these low-risk chest pain patients, what we should be discussing with these patients is that they need a provocative testing within 72 hours. I don't know where they get 72 hours from, but they say within 72 hours, these patients need to have provocative testing, be it a stress test, a nuke med test, a cardiac catheterization. And if you can't secure that for that patient, then that's concerning. I'm going to let somebody else soapbox about whether these tests are actually warranted, but I will say that it can be very difficult. If you don't have a system in place of where you can get these patients out, then it can be tough to send somebody out. If I know I can send you to your private cardiologist that you have on personal retainer, and they will see you at midnight tonight to do a stress test because you've got really good health insurance, then, all right, I'm going to feel a whole lot more comfortable about that. If I know that you don't have transportation, you live 5 hours away, and the only way to get here is by the helicopter that brought you in, you're not going home.
Right. I agree with that. You know, the provocative testing thing, it's we're trying to do provocative testing to see, we know you're not having an MI now. What we're trying to do is we're going to do a provocative test to see if you have intervenable coronary artery disease, right? So my question is, and this is not my area of expertise, so this is mostly opinion. My question is, how many of these new stresses, cardiac caths, whatever, are leading to stents that weren't causing disease, that weren't the cause of the chest pain? Right? What's disease? Disease is, in my opinion, would be chest pain from a high-grade lesion. If you have a 50% lesion that is causing demand ischemia when you exercise, that's disease. But if you have a 70% lesion and it's not causing demand ischemia because you have a bunch of collaterals, is that disease? Because this is what I mean when I say when we diagnose more of it, it changes the prevalence and the meaningfulness of the risk factors.
All right, so let's talk a couple papers. So the HART score. This is a prospective validation of the HART score for chest pain patients in the emergency department. So the HART score takes five factors into play. So it takes your history, your EKG, your age, your risk factors, Framingham risk factors, and your troponin. And it puts all those into a little algorithm blender, and if it spits out a score of less than 3, then it excludes short-term major adverse cardiac events with a greater than 98% certainty. This sounds great. So all you have to do is make sure that your history is not suspicious, that your EKG looks normal, that you're not older than 65, that you don't have any risk factors, and that your troponins are totally normal. So sounds good. Yeah. Sounds like what we'd all like to do.
That it tells you which ones the no-risk patients are.
Exactly. So, you know, before I grade too badly on papers, because I am by no means an expert researcher, there are certain things that we have to document. Document our gestalt, the PERC rule. We had to come up with a PERC rule specifically so that we could say, all right, these are patients you don't need to even consider the D-dimer on. And in fact, we could come up with another rule. You and I should come up with a rule of people you don't even need to consider the PERC rule for, like people with ankle sprains, people that were shot in the face, and people that are actively giving birth. Maybe not that third one, but those three patients, those three types of patients, you don't even need to consider PERC because their risk of having a PE is so low. Right. We can include dead patients too.
We include no risk patients in our low risk category. And what we really need to do is say these are no risk, and then these are the low risk patients.
Right. So the HART score is a nice idea. Some of those things, you know, make sense, but it's not going to catch everybody. And really, we're trying to get the needle in a haystack kind of patients. And these are ones that can be tough. The Vancouver rules is another one that has been thrown out there as a clinical prediction rule for early discharge of patients with chest pain. They're trying to say, you know, my emergency department gets absolutely constipated by chest pain patients waiting for their 4 to 6 hour troponins. Let's turn some patients around in 2 hours. How about that? How about we do that? So they look to see anybody at least 25 years old. I haven't seen a whole lot of 25-year-old MIs unless they were doing a bunch of blow. How about you?
Type 1 diabetics from the time of
birth. All right, fine. So they look at these patients to see within 30 days, are they going to have something bad? And the Vancouver rule says that they're pretty good at being able to identify patients that are low risk for acute coronary syndrome. First thing you need is an initially normal EKG. EKG and no prior history of ischemic chest pain. So ischemic
normal is stone cold normal, not even LVH.
The only acceptable finding is T wave flattening. You can have flat T waves, but you can't have inverted T waves. And then as far as their history of ischemic chest pain, they can't have ever in the past had a diagnosis of MI or angina or had nitroglycerin prescribed to them. They can't have a history of effort-related angina. So there you go. If you're less than 40, you've got a normal EKG, no chest pain, they say, beat it. You're out of here. Time to go. If you're older than 40 and you've got some low-risk chest pain characteristics, which is that the pain isn't radiating to your arm, neck, or jaw, or that it increases with a deep breath, it's pleuritic, or it increases with palpation, those patients you can check one troponin. It's not a troponin, it's a CKMB. And if it's normal, they go home. If it's elevated, then they say, all right, check another EKG and another CKMB in about 2 hours and see how they're doing. How do you feel about that one?
I think it's just as unhelpful.
Why is it unhelpful, though? People are trying really hard. This is a disease that people were dying left and right from MIs, 30, 40 years ago. And we've really been able to save lots of lives with emergent cardiac catheterization. People were dying in droves. And now we've kind of narrowed it down to a very small subset, but we're so worried about it. So people are trying to help out. What's not helpful about this?
We're trying to identify the low-risk patients, not the no-risk patients, right? And all these rules are just identifying the no-risk patients. I mean, we as a society have come up with this ridiculous number that we can't miss more than 1% or 2% MIs, right? Those are MIs, not acute coronary syndrome. And so we've just translated that into we can't miss more than 1% to 2% of acute coronary syndrome, unstable angina or whatever. We'll pick up the NSTEMIs because we get troponins on these people. But the point is that I think this is just the cost of doing business. We have 10 million people a year come to the emergency department with chest pain. This is the cost of doing business. And do you really need a score to tell you which patients are the no-risk patients? I think if you're an algorithm-driven type person or an algorithm-driven type system, then yeah, it's probably helpful. But if you're not, it's probably not helpful.
This again goes back to, these algorithms right now, it kind of seems like, well, yeah, that makes sense. Of course that makes sense. Why do we need to have an algorithm for it? Well, we used to think that washing your hands was just, something you could do if you wanted to. It takes a lot to get to this point, but I mean, decision rules on their own help to train the gestalt of the next class that's coming up. So I think that they are useful, but they are not the end all be all.
One of our residents sent me this on David Newman's website, the Number Needed to Treat website, and he did a review a couple years ago on low-risk chest pain patient over 40 in the emergency department, and he reviewed the evidence and says that if a patient meets the below criteria, which are low-risk chest pain according to your judgment, an EKG shows no ST elevations or depressions, vital signs are normal, stable, he says, no hypotension, and the troponin or CKMB are negative, and there's no history of coronary artery disease, after two negative troponins at 6 hours, 99.6 will not have a heart attack. All right, so I think we have to be very cautious about what our definitions are. So what we're trying to say, all these risk factors are risk factors for coronary artery disease. And coronary artery disease is a risk factor for an MI at the moment you see the patient, right? What we want to know is, does the patient have a STEMI or not? We've diagnosed that on our EKG, either diagnosed it or not diagnosed it, on our initial EKG within 10 minutes of triage. So now we've eliminated that population. And now we're left with the high, intermediate, and low-risk patients, and I would add no-risk patients, for acute coronary syndrome, unstable angina, or NSTEMI. And the patients that have a concerning story, whatever that be, I mean, we all have different definitions than even what the JAMA paper that we talked about earlier shows, but your gestalt is that this patient has a concerning story, you do two negative troponins, that patient is at low risk of having acute coronary syndrome, or an MI in the next few days, right? It doesn't mean that they don't have coronary artery disease, which is what the provocative test is for.
And they're hoping to intervene with the provocative test and prevent ACS in the future.
Correct. Just because you send somebody home who has coronary artery disease doesn't mean you're sending somebody home to their death, right? They might have coronary artery disease that might need an intervention.
It's very tough to tell that person with 99% stenosis of their LAD, have they had that for the last year? Have they had that for the last day?
Is it the reason for the chest pain? If they have collaterals, it might not be.
And the lesion that actually gets them might have been the 45% lesion that was way proximal that flicked off downstream.
Right, exactly.
Very tough to tell.
The other thing I would add, I think it was the Vancouver rule that talked about not on a never been diagnosed with angina or never taken nitrates for chest pain. Well, how many of our patients, of our 10 million patients annually, or 8 million, whatever it is now, that we send home, go see your PCP or your cardiologist, do they go see their PCP and they say, oh, I was in the emergency department with chest pain and my trope was 0.03 because we have this super sensitive troponin, which maybe that's within margin of error of measurement, right? Doesn't mean it was actually positive. And they say, oh, you probably have angina, here's some nitro. But they don't actually have coronary artery disease or angina, right? We just test a ton of patients, and some of them are going to have 0.03 troponins. That completely messes up the prevalence of the disease, and so we have a harder time actually diagnosing it.
To take ourselves one step further, we're trying to find the needles in the haystack. So we're looking to see, but we're trying to do it while seeing everybody else in the ER. So how else can I get somebody out faster? Well, let me get a more sensitive test.
Right.
So the rate of rise of the troponin I, which is the standard assay that most people use, is somewhere between 4 to 6 hours, which is why the AHA says you need to have a repeat, a serial troponin within 4 to 6 hours. So maybe if I get a more sensitive test, that'll help. So now we have ultra-sensitive troponins. And these ultra-sensitive troponins are picking up like hotcakes. I mean, they will find if you've had even the slightest bit of ischemia from your heart. They go down to the nanograms of troponins. So recommendations are, if you have one of these, if it's negative within 2 hours, that's the rate of rise for your troponin T, the super ultra-sensitive troponins. The problem with that is sometimes you just don't want to know. There are studies that show that a troponin T that is negative within 2 hours of the onset of chest pain is 99% sensitive for the diagnosis of MI. However, what we don't know is what's the intermediary. If you're a little bit higher than that, does that mean you are having an MI?
Wait, how did they diagnose MI?
The diagnosis in this paper was made on patients presenting to the emergency department with chest pain who did not have ST segment elevation and underwent serial testing with conventional troponins. They also got, those are the troponin I's, they also got samples of the troponin T levels, and their final diagnosis was myocardial infarction. So they basically used it against the current gold standard, which is a troponin I.
That's great, but the better question is, what is the false positive rate of the ultra-sensitive troponin?
So that's the thing I was trying to get at is, you know, we know that if it's, all right, great, it's super sensitive, but the trade-off is almost always specificity.
Right.
So we don't have these ultra-sensitive troponins in our shop, but those of you that may be using these, if you work elsewhere, or if you go to a place where they have these, we don't really know what it means if it's slightly positive. It's like a slightly positive D-dimer. The D-dimer of 0.51 gets me every time because that means you have a clot somewhere in your body. I don't know where.
Or it's within the margin of error of measurement.
I don't know exactly what this means. So is it really sensitive? Yeah. Okay, great. That's only helpful if it's negative.
It should be like a pregnancy test. They give you 2 bars or 1 bar.
I wish more things were like pregnancy. I definitely wish that. We've gotten to the point of where we've said, all right, all of our testing that we have available in the emergency department is inconclusive. I won't even say it's negative. It's inconclusive because right now you're not having a STEMI, you're not having an NSTEMI. So we're trying to pick up, are you having unstable angina that could lead to a STEMI or NSTEMI? So AHA recommends that we take you out and stress you.
I can tell you of the patients that I admit for a stress test, a much smaller percentage of those patients than I would like to admit actually get said stress test. most of them get serial troponins and sent home.
So we used to admit a lot of these patients for stress tests. And then finally somebody did some work to say, you know, you could, if you have two negative troponins, two negative EKGs, you feel better, you don't have a great story, but we're still concerned because you have a chest with a heart inside of it that may be having some issues. You will be okay to go get a stress test within the next 48 to 72 hours. And this was a study done in the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2012. So we can do it. However, should we be stressing everybody? Is the ultimate test actually going to help prevent the disease? Is a cardiac cath with a stent actually going to prevent your MI? I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, what we're trying, our job in the emergency department is to say, you have acute coronary syndrome or a STEMI, right? And we've ruled out that, no, you're not having a STEMI. No, you're not having an NSTEMI. And all your markers are negative, your story's so-so, and we got you up and walked you around the emergency department and you didn't get crushing substernal chest pain, so we're going to send you home. At what point is it no longer our responsibility for the patient's outpatient workup of coronary artery disease, right? I mean, it says 48 to 72 hours, so what is the warranty on an emergency department visit? And this is a philosophical question, right? If we're saying 48 to 72 hours, then that is on us. Then we have to make sure that we arrange that patient's stress test within 72 hours. But I would argue that if we're saying we've ruled out acute coronary syndrome, yes, you may have coronary artery disease that might need an intervention. That should probably be the realm of the private practitioner.
So I think that we've tossed around a lot of philosophy, a lot of what ifs. I mean, think about just trauma surgery in general. I mean, we found that taking out the organs is not usually the best idea unless we absolutely have to. I mean, trauma surgeons aren't operating on every patient that comes in a trauma anymore. We've got lots of diseases that we used to be very aggressive with that we find we're not so aggressive anymore. You're a patient with a hemoglobin of 7.9, well, let's push you to a hemoglobin of 12. We found that's not actually a good idea. Wouldn't it be crazy if in 5 to 10 years we find out that doing cardiac caths for anything other than a STEMI is actually deleterious? I mean, who knows how it's going to be, but the literature is just kind of evolving over time, and there are some people that think we should not be doing any provocative testing outside of the ED. However, current guidelines that you will be held to if something goes wrong is that you should be looking for a good story, you should be performing an appropriate physical exam, looking for signs of acute coronary syndrome, specifically the ones that get me, diaphoresis. That's a big deal. A sweaty patient should make you sweaty. You should be doing your screening EKG, your troponins as you see fit, and they recommend a 72-hour follow-up for provocative testing, if you can arrange it.
Dr. Mosier has paged.
Hey, Dr. Mosier. Hey, it's Aaron Leach again down at ER. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
Good. Hey, how'd that last guy do?
He died.
Oh, it's a shame.
Yeah, it was the paralytic with the seizure. That was a good call.
Well, I mean, it stopped the seizure. Really? He died? Oh, okay. Aside from that, I got another one for you. So this is a really sweet 6-year-old lady. She comes in, had a syncopal event in the bathroom, and she was going to the bathroom and just done fell out.
Did she vagal?
Possibly, but I'm not convinced it's not her heart. We did we did some testing here. Her EKG's got a left bundle, and I'm not sure if that's new or old, but she just doesn't really feel well, and she's a little sweaty. So I used the San Francisco syncope rule, and it says that she should come in because she's been a little short of breath, and I got it here in my iPhone. Her blood pressure was like 85 when she came in. She got some fluids, her hematocrit was 28%. So we went ahead and gave her an aspirin, and we loaded her up with some fluids, and she'll be coming up to you in just
a minute. Hold on a second. A, why is she diaphoretic? B, why is her hematocrit 28?
Well, she's probably diaphoretic because, it's Tucson in the summer. I mean, we're all diaphoretic. You know, our air conditioning is not that great down here. Her hematocrit is possibly...
You think it's delusional because you gave her some fluid?
No, I do. Yeah, no, that's probably exactly it. We gave her some... No, but we got the blood first. Yeah, I don't really know. Hopefully that's something you can figure out on your end. That'd be great.
Uh-huh. Did you look at her heart? Did she have heart failure?
No, she's got no history of heart failure. She does look pale, though, like what? Maybe jaundice.
What happened in the bathroom?
She said she was going down. She's been having lots of bowel movements recently, like a lot of, diarrhea, just this nasty black diarrhea that's been keeping her in the bathroom. And I think she probably just, dropped the big one and just, fell out.
I see. So did you guaiac her? For GI bleed?
Well, first of all, this lady's not bleeding. She's syncopized, okay? So I'm admitting her for syncope, not for bleeding. And secondly, I'm an attending. I don't do rectal exams, okay? I did residency. I'm done. You know the contraindications to a rectal exam. No rectum, no finger, no resident. Am I right? I gotta go. There's a code that... Wait, that's this patient. I gotta go.
So again, beware of algorithms.
Lots of things are connected to the heart bone.
Yes, lots of things are connected to the heart. As the orthopods will even admit, somewhere the bone is connected to the heart.
Exactly.
All right. So I hate syncope. Granted, I work in peds mostly, and so most of the syncope I see is, turns out to not be emergent. I won't say it's nothing. It turns out to be something maybe supratentorial. But I don't like syncope because there are a lot of bad things that it should be. And, patients that should be admitted should be admitted. You definitely have to make sure you look for all these things. You can't hone in on its one thing. Syncope is the heart, not always.
Yeah, it's probably most likely a volume depletion issue, whether that's from bleeding or dehydration. There's a difference between dehydration and volume depletion. It's probably a volume depletion issue or an autonomic dysregulation issue. Sometimes you can have valvular disease or dysrhythmias or cerebrovascular disease that lead to your syncope, and that's what you have to find.
So, 50-year-old woman comes in, just had a syncopal event. What are the high-yield questions for you? What are the things that you absolutely want to know about that patient to help you determine, are they having something real, or did they vagal on the toilet?
Yeah, well, I want to know the circumstances of the syncope. Did they just get up after prolonged sitting, get up too fast, and get lightheaded? Were they dizzy or anything prior to that? Were they having palpitations or chest pain? Or have they had any of those things in the preceding interim period, a week, 2 weeks, whatever?
One of the most important questions I ask any patient is, what were you doing right before this happened? And generally, they'll say, nothing, nothing. Were you watching TV? Were you sitting there? Oh, well, I was going up the stairs. Oh, exertion. Okay, that helps a little bit. I will also really push to ask people specifics for what you want. I ask ask every syncope patient, did you have any chest pain or feeling like your heart was racing before this happened? No, don't think so. Did you have any headache or trouble breathing? No, didn't have that either. Because I'm looking for dysrhythmia, acute coronary syndrome, PE, and subarachnoid hemorrhage. And those are things that may be helpful. I mean, I still have not picked up the subarachnoid hemorrhage that had the worst headache of their life and passed out, but I'm looking for those.
I had a couple other questions onto that. I usually ask them about dark tarry stools or bloody stools. Usually when people have bloody stools, they'll come in and say, oh, I've had bloody stools, but not with dark tarry stools, you know, so I'll ask them about Mallinic stools. I ask them about chest pain or palpitations, particularly with exercise, especially in, you know, the teenagers when they do come in with syncope, you know, do you get chest pain or palpitations when you exercise? I ask them about family history of cardiac arrest or dysrhythmia. Does anybody in your family have a pacemaker put in at an early age? Those kinds of things.
So once we've gotten through the initial quick burst of history, I'm doing my physical exam to look at their vitals. I'm listening to their heart for murmurs, especially something like aortic stenosis. I'm listening for a harsh systolic murmur. I'm listening to their lungs to hear if there's crackles that would make me think of heart failure. And then I am looking at their sclera to see if they're pale, to see if maybe they're anemic and that's why they passed out. Anything else you look for on physical exam?
Not really.
Okay. So now we've got them here. Do you have a syncope workup in your back pocket that you go, every patient with syncope gets blank?
That's a good question.
I do. And granted, where I work, I see mostly 21 and under and the peds ED. On the adult ED, I have a totally separate thing. But 21 and under, I usually say, you're probably not having a heart attack. You could be having a PE, but let me take your history. We'll kind of think about it. You could be having a subarachnoid hemorrhage, but I doubt it because you're talking, texting, you know, look fine right now. So what I'm looking for is I'll get a CBC to look for anemia. I'll get a BMP to look for signs of electrolyte disturbance, dehydration, acute kidney injury, and I'll get a finger stick blood sugar while they're there. I'll get an EKG to look for dysrhythmia or signs of structural heart disease like hypertrophy someplace, and I'm getting that pregnancy as soon as possible, especially if you look crappy. And if you don't look well and you just passed out, I'm going to be doing my rush exam.
You don't want to be the guy that missed the ectopic.
Oh, no, those are bad. Those are bad. When an ectopic is bad, it is bad. It's incredible how you can bleed to death inside yourself. It's just unbelievable. So that's kind of my garden variety syncope workup.
Yeah, I usually get orthostatics on top of that. I'll throw the ultrasound on their heart and look and see if I see anything grossly abnormal.
So I don't really care about orthostatics, but I know the admitting team does. So what does orthostatics mean to you as somebody who might admit somebody?
Well, to me, I know it's supposed to mean a volume depletion issue, but to me, it really makes me worry more about some kind of autonomic dysregulation issue. You know, if I'm going to admit them, do they need a tilt table test or some other workup for their syncope? Do they need a formal echo? Do they need a carotid duplex? Those kinds of things.
Okay. With the older patient, I'm throwing in troponins. I'm not going to scan every little old lady that falls down, at least scan their chest, but I might scan their head because some of the worst falls are fall from standing because there's something else bad that happened. For me, it's a risk versus benefit of the radiation of a head CT when you're 80 years old versus the potential badness you could have going on inside there.
How do you make sure it's not the aorta?
That they're not having a dissection.
Yeah.
Usually, I will do some of the simple screening stuff of my physical exam. I'll ask them, did you have chest pain, ripping, tearing before you went down? I'll look at the x-ray for any of the stuff that's going to be obvious. And then I watch them for a little bit. If it's a dissection and it's progressing, it's excruciatingly painful. So that's usually enough for me to say probably not a dissection that puts you on your butt. What about you?
Yeah. I usually ask them, do you have belly pain? Do you have back pain? Those kinds of things. And if they, do you have a history of AAA? I'll look back in the chart if they have a history of a AAA. Look back and see if they have any previous imaging that showed a AAA. I don't really go hunt. I mean, I guess you could get crazy and work up every possible etiology of syncope in every patient, especially the older they get. But I just think you can't, there's too many different etiologies that are unrelated. You can't do that. It's not realistic.
Right. So again, syncope is not just the heart. So our illustrious ER doctor invoked the San Francisco syncope rule. So remarkably, he actually invoked it correctly in that, yes, this patient needs to be admitted, but missed the reasons why. So San Francisco syncope rule gets a lot of flack that you are going to over-admit and that you're going to miss some people that do have serious things. I think that if you have any of the things on the San Francisco syncope rule, congestive heart failure, hematocrit less than 30, abnormal EKG, something that's new, or a BP less than 90, you bet I'm going to admit you. I'm not going to send you home with that.
Yeah, that's a no-brainer.
Shortness of breath, that's, you know, plus minus if I can find a reason. If you, you know, maybe you don't have a PE, maybe you don't have CHF, but I've worked those up and found that those are okay, maybe plus minus. But the San Francisco syncope rule was great at identifying high-risk people. And this is, again, something that you could just say, well, duh, but until somebody came up with that, we didn't have it so nicely put together in our brains. This is something else that we use to train our gestalt. What we're looking for is high-risk features. We've got those. Now we need low-risk features, or, as you said, no-risk features. And the low-risk features are going to be tough. The no-risk features are the patient that's here that passed out every day for the last week and that has some significant psychiatric disorders. Or the patient that's clearly has vertigo on exam and fell over because they were completely ataxic. These are patients that you have an alternate diagnosis. No, they don't need to be admitted. You found another diagnosis. So those are
the guy who just started a alpha blocker for BPH, you know, passes out after he starts it.
The stoner that's been on his couch watching Scooby-Doo reruns for the last 6 hours and gets up real fast to go get some more Cheetos. That guy does not need to be admitted.
I guess I would say that, you know, what are the gray area, what do you do with the gray area patients? And for me, the gray area patient is the middle to older age patient who has coronary artery disease risk factors, right? The Framingham risk factors, who I can't find a emergent etiology for their chest pain, but they either just kind of don't look funny. I mean, they don't really have an easily explainable way for them to have syncope, or they don't have rapid follow-up, right? I mean, those patients do need an echo and a carotid duplex and things like that. And even though you found that they're not having a GI bleed, they don't have, you know, acute coronary syndrome at the moment, they didn't have a giant stroke at the moment that made them pass out, but they have risk factors for those, and you can't guarantee that they have rapid follow-up or explain it away as a vasovagal episode, something like that. I admit those patients. I'll be honest, if they could see their neurologist or their cardiologist the next day, I wouldn't, but here they can't, and so I admit them.
So I would say, with any of these gray area patients, you have a discussion with them. Here's what we're able to look for. Here's what we're not able to look for. I honestly don't know what caused you to pass out. It could be one of these other things. So it could be something like orthostasis, vasovagal syndrome, something else like that, that I don't really have a great test for. But here is what I want you to do. Here's what I want you to come back for. How do you feel about this plan? And the patient that you can convince that, you know, they don't have anything bad, you've risk stratified them for emergent stuff, I think that they can go home if they feel comfortable with it, if they've got good resources, if they don't live 5 hours away by horse, you know. These are patients that you can send home. If there's anything concerning about it, to admit them is reasonable, but you have to discuss this with the patient. We're never going to find a black and white, this patient's going to have something bad, this patient's not, or else we won't need doctors anymore. We'll have a nice Google algorithm that will tell you what your disease is.
Yeah, don't forget sepsis either. I had a patient the other day, a little old lady passed out. Why'd she pass out? She passed out standing up, sounded like orthostatic hypotension. The reason she had orthostatic hypotension is because she had a raging pyelo.
Yeah. Nice. So sepsis can do it. GI bleeds can do it. Subarachnoid hemorrhoids. Ooh, that would be bad.
That would be bad.
Subarachnoid hemorrhoids. Oh, that would be the worst headache of your life.
So ruptured ectopics.
Consider the bad things. And remember, syncope is not just the heart. Could they have actually had a seizure? Yeah, it's possible. Look for signs of a seizure. Get a history from somebody that saw them. Keep these things in mind, and your workup should be prompted always by your differential. Why do I have a garden variety syncope workup? Because I see a very similar population that tends not to have bad things when they have a syncopal episode. When I'm seeing older patients that have a syncopal episode, I get a little more nervous because there's more likelihood, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to have something bad. So now I'm not just punting. I'm actually being led by what the patient's telling me. And I do that with the younger patients too.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am.
So I was fortunate enough yet again to get to sit down with Dr. Peter Rosen and pick his brain and his decades of experience about some of the art of medicine that we get to do in the emergency department. This time, we asked him to be a little bit more personal as he recently had a bout of chest pain that landed him in the emergency department. He's going to be talking about this, so hopefully it's not a HIPAA violation. But I asked him about being a patient in the emergency department and being an emergency physician, let alone the emergency physician. How well do we do at describing to patients what's going on during their stay, what's going on with their care, and especially if we reach the end, we find that you're not having a STEMI, you're not having an end STEMI. What do we tell the patients, and how do we describe the next steps?
Well, before I answer the personal question, let me just make a couple of general statements. Ischemic chest pain is an important problem. It's an important problem because it's changing from ST elevated MI to non-STEMI. And the reason that that's important is that STEMIs are unusual in that we have a good therapy for them. It is time constrained, and it does make a difference. But we have no similar therapy for NSTEMIs. What our therapy for NSTEMI is quality of life improvement. It doesn't extend life. It doesn't take away the risk of dysrhythmia or sudden death, but it does take away the discomfort of angina. And there is no good medical therapy for angina. So it really does make a difference to have your ischemic vessel stented. The problem is we don't know which vessel is causing the angina. So most of the time we're guessing. And we really have to sometimes do it by experience in the sense that we think this is the vessel, we stent that vessel and you still have angina, then we'll stent another vessel. Now, in terms of what we tell patients about the disease, the problem is more generic than for chest pain. The problem is we've become very comfortable at ruling out important, critical, life-threatening diseases. But we've become very uncomfortable with assigning a diagnosis without what we consider adequate proof. So what we do is tell the patient what he doesn't have, and what we don't do is tell the patient what he likely has as the cause of his symptoms. That leads to a great deal of patient discontent. To become personal, I entered the hospital not with an ischemic chest pain. In my mind, I was having a pulmonary embolus. I'd had a very difficult, hard journey from Boston to Tucson. I woke up with pleuritic chest pain. I was short of breath, and I had pain that was totally different from the angina that I've had for 30 years. So in my mind, yes, I was always at risk for ischemic pain, and maybe this was a new variety of it, and I certainly don't object to ruling it out, but what I do object to is that what I wanted to understand is where did that pleuritic chest pain come from? Now, they did do a PE workup on me, and it was also negative. The problem being, they never did a D-dimer because they were going to do an imaging study. They did an imaging study, and I asked for an MRI because I have some kidney dysfunction and I didn't want to die load. And the MRI was negative. Well, in my mind, that did not rule out PE because I think I probably had a subsegmental one that just didn't show up. But in the minds of my physicians, I did not have a PE because they couldn't prove it with an imaging study. So when I asked what I did have, they shrugged their shoulders and told me what I didn't have and sent me home. I was comfortable with my diagnosis, but I'm a physician and I know how to think medically. Our patients aren't. And that's what makes our patients very angry. They come into the hospital with a set of complaints. They leave with a set of complaints. Nobody tells them what it caused them. And in many instances, nobody fixes them. And our notion that, well, we can't prove what they do have in the emergency department, but we prove they didn't have an immediate life threat, is not adequate for the patient. As I've told some of the residents in the past, my father was a GP, and I worked in his office one summer when I was in medical school. And he had this wonderful machine. It had lights, and it made a lot of noise, and it could spray, and it could suck. And he used to spray sore throats. It was a really nice-tasting liquid. And being a typical medical student, I said to him, well, I read a paper about that, and it says topical treatment of sore throats doesn't help any. He says, you know that, I know that, but the patient doesn't know that. And it makes the patient feel better, and if the patient feels better, he pays my fees and I pay your tuition, which, by the way, he didn't do. But the point, which I've taken away since that experience, is you got to make patients feel better. That is part of your responsibility, not just diagnosis. And part of making them feel better is telling them what's wrong. And one of the things that I feel we used to do better because we were more comfortable doing it, not because we were better at it, is using clinical judgment about what the probable cause of the problem was. We still have to do that, but we have stopped doing it because we rely too much on images and laboratory tests. So if we don't have positive images and laboratory tests, we're afraid to say this is a diagnosis that is probable for you. I think we've got to go back to that. That's what patients come to us for, and part of their feeling better is knowing what their problem is and what the natural history of that problem is going to be. It helps us to advise them on how to be safe after they leave, and it helps them to get better. So I think that's something that we need to be teaching more, and it's something we need to be doing more. You've got good brains, use them. You can't prove everything with an imaging study and a laboratory study because, number one, they are not 100% positive nor accurate, and mistakes are made both in obtaining them and in interpreting them.
Well, you can tell everybody, yeah, you can tell everybody, go ahead and tell everybody, I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man.
Welcome again to the Peer Review. This is Brian Drummond for August 2015. Today we're talking about low-risk acute coronary syndrome workups as well as syncope. So let's start with low-risk acute coronary syndrome. I think Aaron and Jared did a good job with this section. I don't have too much to criticize, but just want to expand upon a few aspects. One, risk factors. Risk factors for acute coronary syndrome or coronary artery disease are really risk factors of lifetime risk, not risk of
an event today. So when we talk about low-risk chest pain or low-risk acute coronary syndrome, we're really caring about today. Risk factors just aren't that important. And if they were, when I was in Guam, everybody had hypertension, diabetes, the high blood, the high sugar, and high cholesterol. And they came in all the time. And that's because they drank beer, ate Spam, and barbecued. And that's all they did. So everyone was at risk. But you can't admit all those people, and not all those people have the disease. They asked the question of what is a good story. And I think when you pull out a good story from a patient, you're looking at both typical and atypical symptoms. Things such as chest pain, pressure, reproducibility, sharpness, duration, shortness of breath, dyspnea on exertion. Have they been tired? Have they been weak? Have they been sweating? Have they been vomiting? You're asking all those questions, so you kind of come up with what is a good story. Does it matter if it's 1 out of 10? No. You care where the pain is, how long it's lasted. If it's lasted a second, that's probably not important. If it's lasted for 16 days, probably not an important risk factor. But if it's lasted 30 minutes, an hour, they've never had this before, those are more concerning historical factors, and those are the people that you feel have a better story and you're more concerned about. Their pretest probability goes up. So when we're talking about all this and we're looking at this, we have to realize we are doing a really good job with chest pain patients. So some background on what we're doing. We realized that we had people dying of coronary disease, and we were trying to identify what were the people who were the sickest and those who we could affect. And we identified that people with ST elevations on their EKG were important, and we could cause a mortality reduction with thrombolytics and later on with coronary cath and percutaneous opening of those vessels. And we realized, and Aaron was mentioning, there's a mortality difference, and we stopped all these people from dying. Well, we didn't really stop everyone from dying, Aaron. Our pre-intervention mortality rate was around 11% for STEMIs. With lytics, we dropped that to 9%, which is absolute risk reduction of 2%. That's real. And with cath, we dropped it to about 7%, a 4% absolute risk reduction of mortality. Those are real things. But that's for a STEMI. We realized that people with ST depressions or T-wave inversions, lytics did not work and actually hurt those patients. Then there was a concern by people who created the guidelines and others and drug manufacturers that created said, if STEMI is bad, there's got to be other people. And as Jared alluded to, we expanded our net. We started including people with a disease that we labeled NSTEMI. NSTEMI, okay, meaning they have, by definition, a positive biomarker. We used to have different biomarkers. Today we're using troponins. We used to use CKMB. CKMB is a more specific test, but troponins is a more sensitive test, less specific. So now we're catching more people for disease. Now, is there a mortality difference the same in NSTEMI? Not really. We're not dropping that absolute mortality difference. Now, are we identifying people with coronary artery disease and probably needing some adjustment of risk factors and maybe a cath? Possibly. We are, but we created a different lower risk population in the NSTEMI group compared to the STEMI group. We then took this and said, well, there are people with what we call unstable angina. Well, what is unstable angina? It means they have some kind of symptoms that you're worried about with normal EKGs and normal troponins, but they're still worrisome. So now we've gone from a disease where we noted EKG changes, knew we made a mortality difference, to a biomarker that has more false positives. We've now gone to not even defining an injury to the heart with that biomarker or an EKG change, but just a story. And part of this was, there's a long history with drug manufacturers and guidelines and people in our specialty who put out and said, we need to be worried about these people. And we started doing things like glycoprotein inhibitors. We started doing enoxaparin for everybody that came in with chest pain. And we went really aggressive, feeling that we could make a difference. but there was never any difference that we were making in these patients. So now we have this big made-up syndrome of acute coronary syndrome encapsulating all three of these branches. I don't have to say these people don't have disease, or their chance of having disease in the future is not there, but their chance of disease and dying from it today is low. So, what is our gold standard that we're testing with all this? The gold standard of acute coronary syndrome, including all of those, would be a histologic diagnosis, right? We'd have to cut open their coronary arteries and look. If their coronary arteries were occluded at that point with an unstable plaque with a thrombus on top, we know that they have probably had a myocardial infarction from that. We also know if we cut open their coronary arteries and we looked at it, we could see, yeah, there's some significant narrowing, but the plaque is stable, so therefore, no issues. So that's our gold standard, right? But we've transitioned to from a histologic to an anatomic gold standard. We're using coronary cath as our gold standard. And cardiologists, there may be a 30% narrowing on that coronary cath. And with that, they say no real disease. But somehow at 70%, that's real disease. Well, 70% probably is some narrowing that's now causing them some functional limitation, but doesn't tell us anything about the stability of the plaque, because the plaque rupture is what's causing these people to have an acute thrombosis and an MI. So, our gold standard's touchy, our definitions are touchy. So how do we take all this with these low-risk patients? You have to realize we do a really good job at this. So I'll throw an article, the Pope article, New England Journal of Medicine 2000, talks about how good are we. And a lot of people quote this, that we miss 2% of MIs. But if you look at the article, over 10,000 patients presenting to the ED, we missed 0.04%, less than 1%, less than 0.5% were missed MI or unstable angina in a population that over 10% of these patients ruled in. That's a pretty high-risk population. Now, most people we see with chest pain don't rule in, and I'll probably say our population incidence of disease is less than 10%. But in this study, and there hasn't been another one that I know of that's as big, doesn't show that difference. So we're doing a really good job, right? 0.4% we're missing, all right? And those are people we sent home. So if we're doing that, and that was published in 2000, and that was before we have our troponins and EKGs. That was what we were doing with just some history, maybe an EKG, maybe a biomarker like CKMB. We were doing that. So now we're doing much more. So we have to be doing better than that. We're probably missing less than 0.4%. But why do we care about this issue? And why are Jaron and Arad talking about it? They're talking about it because it's not the risk of the patient. It's not the risk of anything other than us. We're trying to manage our own risk. We know that coronary disease can pay out in lawsuits, and we worry about that. But we have to know we're doing a really good job. So you're doing really well just with your gestalt, your EKGs, your chest x-rays, your sense of what's going on with the patient, some biomarkers, and you know who you want to keep and know who you want to send home. And you're doing a really good job. So, with that in mind, in this very unstable environment of a wandering disease, a wandering gold standard, no real good studies, we're trying to manage our own risk, which is hard to do. It's a hard thing to do. So Arad is referring to the guidelines here and what we should do, right? So guidelines, you always have to take with a grain of salt, and who put them together, and are they methodologically sound? And if you like to follow guidelines over the years, you'll see that they change all the time. Sometimes forward, sometimes backward, sometimes sideways. And Arad and Jaron talked about the testing at 72 hours and doing more tests. Well, you know, I'm probably not a big tester. So if we look at sensitivity and specificity of all these risk stratifying tests within 72 hours, they're pretty low, right? a stress test, maybe in the 70s for sensitivity and specificity. The cardiac coronary disease studies are already only done in, or the CT coronary studies are done in low risk patients as is. So they have a really low risk of disease, almost a no risk of disease, and you're doing a study to show that they don't have any more risk. Now, those are nice in some ways because you can say, well, if it's negative, your chance of, you know, it's totally normal. Your chance of disease in the next 5 years from coronary artery disease, pretty low, pretty low. Just like a completely clean cath does the same thing. But again, they're an anatomic test. Stress echo and all these things, again, their sensitivity and specificities are not great. So we have a lot of these tests then lead us to extra interventions, extra percutaneous opening of their vessels. Not good, right? It's cost, there's complications, there's bleeding, you're conferring people to medicines and other things that they may not need. And we know that this is the case. We've seen a huge amount of stents done with no real benefits for the patients. Now, some symptomatically feel better. I'm not saying no one should get this, but I'm saying we have to be able to filter who needs to go and have those tests. If you put a better population to a test to ask a specific question, you will have less false positives and less false negatives. If you apply the test to everyone, you're all over the place. So apply your tests to who you really think needs it. The Heart Score and the Vancouver Rule are two of many risk factors, clinical decision rules. How do we incorporate all this knowledge? Well, you know, and there's people in our community that really like the Heart Score, and there's people that like the Vancouver Rule. They used to, you know, TIMI, people still use TIMI, but none of these scoring systems really apply to your patient today. You're already doing it. Now, if you need a clinical scoring rule to kind of get how your gestalt is, I understand that, but the Heart Score is your history, your EKG, the patient's age, their risk factors and troponin. That's my normal workup. I don't need a Heart Score to tell me what my workup includes because I do that anyway. So it doesn't add anything. I can have a Heart Score of 2 for positive troponin, and if it says it's less than 3, I should send them home. Well, I'm probably not going to send that patient home with a troponin of 0.5. That just doesn't make sense. So these clinical decision rules, I think, can cloud your picture. Know that they're including things that you should be asking and addressing in your history and physical and workup. And that's all you need to do. I also think they address the ultrasensitive troponin testing. I don't think ultrasensitive troponins are going to be helpful at all. I think they're going to harm us. They're going to be really high sensitivity, but they're going to be low specificity, and they don't add anything to this low-risk group that I need. Now, I'm a specificity person. I want my tests more specific. I am not a shotgunner. I want to be a sniper. All right? So I don't want a super sensitive test that I don't know what to do with when it's positive on half my patients. Now I got to filter a whole nother thing. So I'm not a big fan of the ultrasensitive troponin. I'm glad we don't have it, and I hope we don't. So all this nonsense with a disease that's hard to grasp, a workup that's hard to understand, they're already low risk. We know in the sickest patients with STEMI, we already make minimal difference in mortality, a real difference, but it's not a 50% mortality reduction. So what do we do? Well, I think my approach is this. So I have three groups I put people in that I'm thinking about acute coronary syndrome or doing their workup. One, they have a good story and they're getting admitted. And the good story could be a STEMI. The good story could be new EKG changes. The new good story could just be a good story. But if they have troponin positive, EKG changes, good story, they are a one trope, two EKGs in 30 minutes, and I admit them. I'm done. At the 1 hour mark, I'm done with this patient. If you got bedside troponins, two EKG, at the 30 minutes, I'm done with this patient. And they should be going upstairs. The second group is no risk. And Jared and I use this no risk term. And really, it's a very, 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 very low risk. There's always a possibility of these people having a risk, but it is so low, we'll call it no risk. So this is the 20-year-old chest pain for 5 seconds and went away. They're going to get a chest x-ray, EKG, and be discharged. The third group I put it in is really my workup group. And this group is, the story's not great. Maybe they have coronary disease, but this isn't their Angelone equivalent. Maybe this is the first time they've had pain, but it's lasted for 2 days. So it's something that, it's not a slam dunk admission for me. So these are someone I'm trying to get home. That's the whole goal of this third group. And what I do for them, they get two EKGs in the first 30 minutes. They get two troponins, 2 hours apart, and I look for a delta. And I have them follow up within 72 hours with a cardiologist or a primary doctor. Now you say, well, I can't always do that. I understand. Can't always do that. That's okay. You want them to come back and see you? Totally fine. I think that's reasonable. How are you feeling, sir? We do this for other things. Have them follow up with you. The 2 hour troponins, why do I do that? Is it the most validated and externally validated and proven stuff? No. It's been in the guidelines for NSTEMI workups. They've included, and I use a delta value, so I look for a change in troponin. There's some small studies looking at this, but I'm really looking for a rise in my troponin. So if I have a downgoing troponin, maybe I had an indeterminate in the 0.04 and the next one's 0.02, that's downgoing, right? It's not escalating. Well, or I have two completely normal troponins, the delta is fine. It's, they're going home. If I have a rising troponin, maybe the first one's undetectable and the second one is 0.10, that's a rising troponin. That person's either going to get admitted or I do a 4 hour troponin with them. But the goal with this delta is I want to see things downgoing. I used to do CKs and CKMBs with the troponins. I've just kind of stopped doing that. But that was also in the 2006 guidelines that you can do deltas with CKMBs in 2000 as well. So I use a delta and I use a 2 hour. By me doing two EKGs, a single troponin, and looking at the patient, I have already probably reduced their risk I've reduced the risk of me missing something pretty low, right? We know from Pope it was 0.4%. That was with CKMBs, maybe it was one of them. So if I'm doing a single one, the chance of them having a true disease or walking away and dying is the same as the chance of them probably dying with nothing. In that Pope study, there was no mortality difference in the people that were missed. So I feel good about that. Then if I'm doing 2 hour tropes on them, great. Now I will do a single trope sometimes if they've had symptoms for greater than 8 to 12 hours. So sometimes I've had 10 hours of pain, started last night, I went to bed, it's been there the whole day, and now I'm coming in at 3, they're going to get a single troponin and go home. Because that troponin should be positive within that time frame. So those are my three groups. One, quick admission, two EKGs, troponin, admit. Second group, low risk, no risk, EKG chest x-ray, no troponins, discharge. Third group, two troponins, 2 hours apart, two EKGs in the first 30 minutes with a 72-hour follow-up. And with that 72-hour follow-up, the goal is for getting these home. Now, some of those patients will get admitted in the third group, but most of them will go home. Now, there's a group, but they actually did a shared decision-making and asked the patients what they wanted to do in this case. So for these patients, they would say, all right, you've had two EKGs and two troponins. Your risk of an event today is really low. We can't tell you what specifically it is and if you're going to have a heart attack the next day. And we can give you options of A, you want to go home, B, you want to get admitted, three, or C, you want to get a follow-up in a couple days. And they looked at this and they basically did a shared decision making, allowed the patient to fill out a sheet of paper on what they wanted to do. And it allowed the patient and the provider to be in agreement. I think totally reasonable approach, and it's probably a good thing for you to document. I did shared decision making with the patient. They want to go home. They're going to see their cardiologist, or they want to follow up with their regular doc. Totally fine with that. I think that's a very reasonable approach. So, hard topic, acute coronary syndrome workup. What do you do with it? Second topic was our favorite ER doc, Dr. Leach, doing his goofy impersonation of a syncope eval by somebody other than an emergency physician. So I think that they covered a lot of good points. For syncope, I think they hit on, you've got to have them describe the episode, have the patient describe what happened with the syncopal event. What were they doing? Did they have chest pain? Were they having trouble breathing? Did you stand up? Did you see something really gross and you passed out? Have you been out working all day in the hot sun? And then ask specific questions. Ask things like your GI bleed question. I ask almost everybody if they're pooping blood or pooping black. I ask if they're peeing blood or, you know, hurts when it pee. Those are common things we ask in our review system. So ask these common things that you would look for or expect in someone with a bad cause of syncope. Jared mentioned orthostatics. There's lots of studies that show orthostatics have no value, so I don't really use them. If they feel lightheaded when they stand up, probably some component of hypovolemia. But I don't do orthostatics. I know some people love them, and maybe the admitting teams need them, but I don't think they are of much value. In terms of ordering and workup EKG for all these people, most of syncope is going to be some kind of vasovagal or autonomic instability or cardiac. If you had to put three categories, those would be your three categories. A EKG for all of them? Yes. I also do a cardiac and aorta ultrasound. They mentioned on dissection, I try to look at the aortic root as well as look for AAA on their aorta. And I also, on my cardiac ultrasound, really want to comment on tamponade, global LV function, and RV size or signs of massive PE. So those are the things that I comment on with my ultrasounds. CTs of the head, I would disagree with Aaron. I don't think they're indicated on most patients, and there's good studies to show syncope patients do not need CT scans of the head. If you're looking for trauma secondary to the syncope, yes, but CT the head for just a syncope with no specific trauma, and I think this is even in the Choosing Wisely guidelines for one of the maybe neurology or radiology. But so I wouldn't order CT scans of the head routinely unless you think they've had trauma to that head. Troponins, I think, are reasonable. Looking at electrolytes or kidney functions, reasonable. I think looking for sepsis causes. Again, get your episode and guide your test based on what they presented with. A lot of these patients will go home, especially the younger they are, the more healthy they are. You have a good reason they're going to go home. There will be some you admit and you just don't know. Little old ladies that had syncope for no reason, probably going to stay in the hospital. Again, just like with acute coronary syndrome evaluations, I don't use clinical decision rules, San Francisco, or any of those. Good history and physical, good reasonable workup, and have a decision and discussion with your patient about where they should stay. That's all I have for August, so thank you guys very much, and we'll talk to you in September.